This is Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Parent. Thank you for joining us. The Australian opposition Liberal Party has launched its official electoral campaign. Leader Tony Abbott set out his vision for the next two decades: stronger budgets and borders, lower taxes, and more jobs. But there is little detail on how it will be delivered. Nevertheless, there would also be no excuses and no nasty surprises. Now, voting is compulsory in Australia, but the electoral authorities acknowledge that up to 20% of eligible voters are not doing so. Informal or invalidating voting is also on the rise. With the September 11th election just around the corner, the figures are significantly challenging the country's major political parties. We have this report from Catherine McGrath.
Australia has compulsory voting, and this country prides itself in being a robust democracy. But around 20% of voters don't vote or vote incorrectly, and their ballot isn't counted. For the young, the figures are even worse. 25% of eligible young voters didn't sign up for this poll. The Australian Electoral Commission that administers the system has published voting figures that show one in five eligible voters didn't do so in the last election. Its research shows 1.5 million people were not enrolled, 900,000 were enrolled but didn't vote last time, and nearly 750,000 votes for the House of Representatives were informal, so they didn't count. Expert in the Australian electoral system, Associate Professor of Law at the University of Melbourne, Ju Cheong Tam, says it's a growing problem that does impact on Australian democracy.
It's concentrated among the young. So we're talking about people who are coming into the political process, reaching adulthood, actually are, for one reason or another, disengaged from the political process. I think this is a set of issues that at the very least deserves serious consideration, and I think there should be much more public concern about that. So I think that's an aspect about the spirit of democracy not being as enlivened as it should be. And the other one, of course, is that there's actually high levels of public disenchantment with politics as it is right now, in particular with the major political parties.
But I do have some expertise in terms of the regulation of elections in Australia.
In Canberra to discuss the Australian electoral system, Ju Cheong says there's much to admire in this country's system, but there are questions to be asked about the political process.
I think the parties themselves are, in some ways, are facing a crisis. I mean, the other part about the spirit of democracy not being as robust is really they're facing declining levels of membership, you know. And we're talking, in terms of proportion, they're basically at historically low levels. And I think one thing the parties have to do is really become more vibrant democratic institutions, much better at involving their members and also much better in involving their supporters.
Thanks for your support for the car industry.
Thanks, mate. No, we're going to be there for the long haul.
Like most elections around the world, policy is focused on local subjects. Occasionally, international issues are mentioned. The opposition is promising to bring its foreign aid focus to the Pacific region.
But I want us to be the partner of choice for countries in the Pacific. With our great friends in New Zealand, I believe it's time for us to change the nature of our engagement in the Pacific.
Aid expert Professor Stephen Howes from the Australian National University believes the opposition would introduce some changes to aid funding if elected.
Yeah, the aid program is already still focused on the Asia Pacific, but if they come in, they will, I think, take funding away from Africa and away from Latin America and the Caribbean. It's a small amount, but they nevertheless remove it and put those funds into the Asia Pacific. You might also see a lower portion of funds going to multilateral sort of global organizations such as the UN, and again that funding being directed into bilateral programs with our Pacific and Asian neighbors.
The current government has significantly increased the foreign aid budget, but it's also recently delayed future spending commitments and diverted around $700 million from the aid budget to help fund asylum seekers being held in Australia. A recent poll showed Australians concerned about the country's debt favour cutting foreign aid as a way of reducing government spending.
That was Catherine McGrath reporting. The Indonesian government has unveiled a raft of emergency measures to revive confidence in Southeast Asia's largest economy. The nation has been battered on several fronts. Foreign capital has left on the expectation of an improvement in the United States. We have this report from Helen Brown in Jakarta.
It's been a moment of harsh reality for Indonesia. Not that long ago, it was a global darling. Now it has a weakening currency, rising inflation, and a growing trade deficit. And ministers, business, and the central bank have stepped up to reassure markets the country is serious about tackling the problems. The coordinating minister for the economy, Hatta Rajasa, led a press conference to explain the moves.
The government and Bank Indonesia are paying close attention to the development of the economy, and the government is fully aware of the impact.
The uncertainty about when the US Federal Reserve will start winding back its stimulus program comes at a bad time for Indonesia. Last quarter, it ran up a current account deficit of almost $10 billion. The gap in the sum of the trade balance and investment income is creating nervousness. Indonesia says it's going to tackle that by encouraging further local growth that encourages exports, putting in tax breaks, reducing costly oil imports, and hiking the tax on some luxury goods. The finance minister, Khatib Basri, says the government's determined to bring the deficit down.
We are in every step to improve the structural problem in the current account deficit. And, you know, as I always said, bad times makes good policy. And this is the proof that bad time really, you know, we can come up with a good policy.
The central banks also made announcements introducing several new policies to keep more US dollars circulating in the system. Last week, it watched as the already volatile currency, the rupiah, dropped to a four-year low. And the share market took another battering. Stocks have fallen almost 20% since May. Bank Indonesia's new governor, Agus Martowardoyo, says the policies will help steady sentiment.
I welcome the policies, and I promised the government that I would keep coordinating and providing input both for the central and local government so that the macro economy will be stabilized.
The government is also apparently loosening the import quotas on beef and some fruit and vegetables in a bid to curb price rises which are pushing up inflation. The quotas have been blasted as protectionist and also caused a dramatic cut to Australia's beef exports. There's still not much detail on what exactly will change, though. It's the kind of detail the markets will be looking for this week.
That was Helen Brown reporting from Jakarta, Indonesia. We now move to a story that involves Australia's top diplomat in Taiwan, a maid, and a local vet. This is how it played out. Australia's new representative in Taiwan. Now, I should mention that Taiwan and Australia don't have full diplomatic relations because Australia recognizes China, but they do have a trade office here in Taiwan. He replaced the previous head of the trade office. While he took over the residence, he also adopted a dog that the previous trade director here in Taiwan for Australia had found in the street. The dog developed a health problem. He told the maid at his residence to bring the dog to a vet and have the dog put down. Dr. Yang, who's a very well-respected vet here in Taiwan, told the maid there was no need to put the dog down, that he could cure the dog. She went away. She came back, and she said, no, the dog must be put down. She paid the money to have the dog euthanized and the money to have the dog cremated, which is around $250, $300 US. Dr. Yang decided to keep the money, use the money to provide health care for the dog, and bring the dog back to health, which is exactly what he did. He decided to keep the dog for himself. And then a few weeks later, the dog, of course, was well enough again that the dog bolted from his residence. He was caught by a local dog catcher here in Taipei. When they scanned the microchip, they found it was the name of the Australian representative here in Taiwan, the previous one, who is now working at the Australian consulate in Shanghai, China. So then, Mr. Kevin McGee, Australia's top diplomat here in Taiwan, went to the police and filed fraud charges against the vet for not putting Benji down. Benji is the dog's name. This story has been getting wide coverage here in Taiwan because Australia's top diplomat in Taiwan, yes, top diplomat in Taiwan is suing a local vet for not putting a dog down because the vet decided to save the dog's life, which he did. Well, this story is just getting a lot of coverage here in Taiwan, like I said, on radio and television. And in the last week or so, it's been making its way to Australia. Next, we're going to hear an interview that was done for radio station 2GB in Australia. The interviewer is Ben Fornham, and he speaks to Sean McCormick, who we had on the program, a local sanctuary owner.
Mate, what a story. What is this bloke thinking? He's our representative there.
Well, that's what everyone else is saying here. What is he thinking? It seems insane to drag everyone's name through the mud, including Australia's, including Dr. Young's, including his own.
I mean, when I first stumbled upon this story and I was reading about it, and it was Tim Elliott's story in the Sydney Morning Herald that alerted me to it, I thought, oh, okay, the dog must have been put down by mistake and that's why he's suing the vet. No, he's suing the vet for not killing the dog.
It's outrageous. And not just any vet. The reason I know Dr. Young is I started 3 animal charities here. Dr. Young has always been our vet because he's so compassionate, gives us credit, gives us huge discounts, and sometimes treats our dogs for free. Over 900 animals he's saved for us so far. This is not just any vet. This is about the most compassionate vet you could possibly need.
Tell me about the reaction in Taiwan and in Taipei and how this has backfired on Kevin McGee, Australia's representative.
Well, it's backfired greatly. That's why we still can't understand why he's doing this. There's uproar. Even those who state that Mr. McGee may have a legal base for this, for what he's doing against a good man, and it can only backfire against him, it's ridiculous. Dr. Young only acted with the very best of intentions.
He's suing a bloke who had a big enough heart to take a sick dog home because he didn't want to see it unnecessarily killed.
Exactly. And he took the money. I have to make this clear. He didn't take the money to pocket it, although it's fair for you to say that. If he didn't, Mr. McGee would have known something was up, and he seemed to want to get the dog put to sleep unnecessarily. Mm. Now, we suspect, because everyone is talking about it online, saying there's something missing, there's a detail missing, why would the Australian representative behave in such a bad way to give such a bad name to your great nation and to Dr. Young? There's something missing here, and we suspect that he may not have been completely honest with the real owner, Miss Court, I think it is, because she would never have agreed to put her dog to sleep knowing that he could be saved.
No, of course, the former Australian representative wouldn't have taken kindly to finding out that news that this guy had done what he has done. I know that it's not helping either, because Australians who are living in Taipei are most concerned, because this is big news there, and people are looking at them saying, what kind of barbaric people are you?
Exactly. Now, Taiwan's a very insular country. They're very welcoming, but they have a distrust of foreigners. Unfortunately, they're all saying, no, what's wrong with these foreigners doing these bad things to our good guys? And putting dogs to sleep is not accepted in Taiwan. This is a very sensitive cultural issue as well.
All right. Well, he is our representative, sadly. Thanks very much for the update, Sean. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sean McCormack joining us on the line, a sanctuary owner in Taipei who's spearheading this campaign to get Kevin McGee to drop the case against the local vet. By the way, it's not the first time Kevin McGee has been caught up in a diplomatic incident. In 2010, a Saudi Arabian translator sought an apology and compensation from the Australian government after an incident with Mr. McGee. The 28-year-old woman had been working with the embassy for one day when Kevin McGee, the Australian ambassador for Saudi Arabia, allegedly lost his temper at a staff function because she declined to shake hands with him in accordance with her local Islamic practice. You would hope that Mr. McGee would know that, wouldn't you? That many, many Muslim women prefer not to shake hands with men, no matter who you are or where you come from, because they only touch their husbands. Kevin McGee, how do we get a job like that? What a bizarre individual.
And that was Ben Fordham from radio station 2GB in Australia, speaking there with Sean McCormick about Australia's top diplomat, I almost said ambassador, but no, top diplomat to Taiwan, who is suing a local vet for saving a dog's life. Very strange indeed, and I'm sure that it's just going to get stranger and stranger, and of course we will continue following it. Now, if you think about drug abuse, one country that probably doesn't come to mind is North Korea. But a new study has shown that methamphetamine, a drug that is widely used by drug abusers is wide-scale in Australia. Next, Sen Lam speaks to one of the co-authors of the report, Professor Kim Sok Hang.
Some informants, some interviewees are saying so, you know, almost every adult in North Korea around a borderline, China, North Korea borderline, using methamphetamine because there is no medical pill when they need it. When you say verify, if it means statistical verified, then it's not. But almost everyone in my interview are saying so, especially those who left North Korea after 2009.
Well, it's also claimed that these drugs are so widely available that methamphetamine can even be ordered as casually as a coffee in a coffee shop.
Yes, that's true. That's what they are saying. It's expensive, it's very expensive, but still, it's not so difficult to get methamphetamine through those restaurants anywhere.
Do we know, Professor Kim, the reason behind this increased drug use?
At first, like in 1999, those who were making methamphetamine in North Korea want to illegally export to China, okay? So they have made such a lot of money by then, but since 2003, 2004, 2005, Chinese government start to strictly ban those illegal import methamphetamine from North Korea. So those who were making money, they don't know how to where to go. So they start to sell it to their neighbor within North Korea. So since then, many of North Korean people start to use methamphetamine. When Kim Jong-un became a leader of North Korea, it's banned by North Korean authority. But the problem is that those police members and other high-ranking officials, they are the one who is fond of methamphetamine. So you're saying
that drugs use is widespread amongst the law enforcement units?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I mean, yeah.
Do you think the rising use of drugs in North Korea, that it could be symptomatic of a very melancholic society, that people are seeking other things?
Yeah, you know, the symptom of those drugs, right? I can feel that way when I have a talk with some of them.
That people are using drugs because they're sad in North Korea.
Yeah. At first, most of them start to use methamphetamine as a medical cure. I mean, actually, their hospital medical system, it stopped for such a long time. So they need to something to kill their pains, the physical pain. But once they get addicted to methamphetamine, there's no way for them to get out of it.
Just very quickly, do you think the widespread use of methamphetamine in North Korea shows that there is more disposable income now, or is that because it's widely available and reasonably cheap?
Using methamphetamine does not mean they have enough money to dispose. They have to get it with all the money they have.
So these are quite desperate people.
Yes. They put all the money they have in methamphetamine.
We now go to Japan. Volcano experts are warning that the magma chamber beneath Japan's Sakamijami volcano is about 90% full, which means a large lava eruption cannot be ruled out. It's been erupting constantly for nearly 60 years, spewing out smoke and ash and sending shivers through the nearly 500,000 people who live nearby. To find out more, we have this story from Mark Willisey.
Sakurajima is one of the world's most active volcanoes. Some years, it belches into life or erupts over 1,000 times. And this bad-tempered beast is just 8 kilometres from the 600,000 residents of Kagoshima.
And recently, Sakurajima showered this city with 100,000 tonnes of ash, turning day into night and sending people scrambling for cover. Its 500th eruption of the year sent plumes more than 5 kilometres into the sky and reminded everyone here just how vulnerable they are to the vagaries of this volcano. But mostly, Sakurajima is just a daily inconvenience.
The most annoying thing is the falling ash. We cannot hang laundry outside. The clothes we wear get filthy and the ash gets in our eyes. People have to sweep it from the front of their houses almost every day.
But the people who are most exposed to the volcano are those who live at its base. You can understand why people may want to live here. It has a stunning coastline and a relaxed pace. And this place is also famous for its fruit and vegetables. Saburo Yokomichi's family has been farming on Sakurajima for nearly 300 years, and he's grown used to the volcano's terrible temper.
When I was a Year 3 student at school, I experienced a huge eruption. The sky became like night from the ash, and I saw lava flowing down the volcano. But I have become used to it. Me and the mountain are like friends.
But Saburo Yokomichi wasn't around when the volcano last really blew its top. The 1914 eruption was the biggest in 20th century Japan, generating a large lava flow as well as a tsunami and leaving about 60 dead.
My father and his family were evacuated to another island. I still think about a large eruption, but we have learned to coexist with the volcano.
Volcanologist Masato Iguchi has been studying Sakurajima for more than 30 years. And while he's not worried just yet about another big eruption, he does warn that pressure underneath the volcano is rising.
The magma level deep within the volcano is back to about 90% of what it was before the 1914 eruption. So we do have to worry about a big eruption in the long term.
That was Mark Wilsey reporting from Japan. And finally on the program, the ancient city of Varanasi is known as the religious capital of India. It is here where many come to die as they believe their death leads salvation from the rebirth cycle. Many foreigners have also made the holy city their home. We have this story from Murali Krishnan.
The crowded streets and chaos is everywhere when one enters Varanasi. Traveling through the old city could be more problematic. It's a maze of buildings, temples, and narrow streets, teeming with thousands of pilgrims and tourists, many who go to the ghats, or steps leading to the Ganges River to take their holy dip. Varanasi is one of those cities which claim to be the world's oldest continuously inhabited cities, along with Hebron, Jerusalem, and Damascus. And looking at the town, battered and crumbling, with antiquated infrastructure, it's not hard to believe. Apart from the regular rush of pilgrims, this seat of Hinduism has also its fair share of Westerners. They have been so much inspired by Indian culture that many of them have made Varanasi their home.
Varanasi of 40-plus years ago is an entirely different Varanasi to the one we have today. There is a peculiarity about Banaras. It's a kind of laid-back, carefree life people used to live or lead here. Banaras was supposed to be a seat of learning, ancient seat of learning.
Christopher Burchett, originally from the UK, has been living here for nearly 40 years. When he came here as a youth for a holiday, he stayed back, married an Indian, and now has grandchildren. Many say the city's spiritual heritage has left a deep impact on the minds of foreigners. Burchett again.
When I first came here, maybe I didn't imagine or even conceive of staying here for a lifetime. Quite honestly, it has been my home for 37 years. I can't imagine living anywhere else.
Those who stay here say Varanasi offers the kind of freedom, both artistic and religious, which no other Indian city offers. Some foreigners have learned Sanskrit, the literary and scholarly language, practiced learning the tabla, the Indian percussion instrument, or picking up Hindustani classical music. So does Varanasi offer so much that foreigners from all over the world want to come here. Paul Drilsma is from Australia.
I mean, there are so many things. I mean, of course, it's the River Ganga is a very special river and has this reverence by all the people, Hindu people and other people. It's just an enjoyable place to be in for a Westerner. It's so vibrant and colourful. sometimes I explain to my friends it's like a 24-hour circus here. You know, there's so much going on in the markets, and the old city is beautiful. I say to people, you could spend 3 years walking the old city and you would never find every niche, and you would never find every Shiva Lingam, because there are so many.
But despite its spiritual appeal and being one of the most visited pilgrimages of the world, Varanasi has over the years fallen to neglect. Despite the relevance of the location for Hindus, environmentalists for years have tried to stop the religious rites from being carried out on the Ganges River. Remains of burnt corpses are scattered about the river, whether they are fully cremated or not. Commercialization of religion too has become rampant. Mr. Burchett mourns this fact.
The Banaras of 40 years ago was something else. Today, it's highly commercialized. And even the spirituality you might find here, from my perspective, it is highly commercialized.
Even Bindeshwar Pathak, a philanthropist who runs a few charities in Varanasi, believes that the city is a magnet only for select foreigners.
They must be a spiritual person. Commercial person cannot stay in Varanasi. So those who are spiritual from countries, certainly they would like to come and settle here because this place is certainly holy and you will find spiritual persons, learned people. You can talk to them. The moment you sit in Ganga Ghat and you get some vibration, some divinity coming from above. So that type of persons only can maybe settle here.
Despite the many problems that plague the city, it still is a draw for foreigners and will continue to play a large role in the religious practices of Hindus, especially those in search of deliverance.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. You can catch another edition of the show on Sunday at 1330 UTC on 11835 kHz for listeners in Southeast and East Asia. And that edition of the program is presented by Andy Sennett. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Until next time, I'm Keith Powell saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days.